Our last speaker, Jay Ingram. He bills himself as someone who got 68 in calculus. Well, lots of people did that, so I'd like to tell you a few other things about this rather remarkable man. Of course, for Canadians, he needs no introduction. He's a very familiar personality. From 1979 to 1992, he was a host of a very nice program, CBC Radio, lively, informative program called Quirks and Quarks. It still exists. And during that time, he won two ACTRA awards, including one for Best Host. Nowadays, he's co-host and producer of the Discovery Channel's daily science TV show. I don't know if it's still a unique show like that in the world, but probably it is a daily science show on TV. And he is to be seen every day working in bringing science to the general public. He's also an award-winning science writer with special interest in language and the brain. And he has actually written four science books, and probably there's more on the way, written for the general public on science. One of them's called Talk, 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 another one, The Barmaid's Brain. He's been awarded the McNeil Medal and the Sanford Fleming Medal, both of them for popularization of science. And he has honorary doctorates from McGill and Carleton Universities for his work in the promotion of science in the public field. So it's a really great pleasure for me to introduce Jay Ingram and to thank him very much for coming to our opening here. Jay. Thank you.
I think it was actually only a 66. I thought of that title kind of on the spur of the moment. And then when I thought back, I thought, no, I don't think I got 68. I should tell you, it was at Bob's University, University of Alberta, but he is not to blame because he had not yet arrived when I was struggling with calculus. However, as you can probably tell from the title of that talk, this is not. I'm not here to talk about mathematics. I think all of you know that one of the goals of BERS is to communicate what is going to go on here over the coming years to the general public. And I see that as a very interesting challenge, and I underline the word challenge. So what I would like to address in this talk are really two things. How difficult I think that challenge of communicating math to the general public might be. And then secondly, I'll offer some I hesitate to use the word vague, but some thoughts on how that challenge might be approached. I would not be so bold as to suggest that I could say how it might be met, but I could suggest how it might be approached. Now, I think first, I'd like to clarify what I think the general public is, because I think that BERS is aiming not to speak to the already mathematically inclined public, however small that public might be, nor to people who are already big fans of science and mathematics and engineering. And rather than use vague terms like that, let me give you some idea of what I think this nuclear audience is that I think we're seeking to broaden. In a recent issue of the journal Science, there was a review of Mario Livio's new book, The Golden Ratio, on the number phi. And I guess I didn't have to tell you that. And in the review, the reviewer was quite happy to note that over the last 5 years, there's been a book called The History of Pi, another book called E, The Story of a Number, two more, The Nothing That Is, A Natural History of Zero, and An Imaginary Tale, The Story of Root Minus One. And there's a book on Euler's constant on the way. Now, only the extremely dedicated will buy and or read these books. And, you know, I'm very careful when I say it, when I actually dissociate buying from reading. Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time was a perfect example of that, and in fact it moved a writer in Time magazine in 1990 to create what he called the fully read index. This actually is the only math I'm going to get into. The fully read index is the product of the author comfort index times the simple prose coefficient. Now, the author comfort index is the amount of egalitarianism generated by writers in their books. So Stephen King, Tom Clancy, Danielle Steele. These are perfect examples of people who make you, who induce egalitarianism. Now, a maximum simple prose coefficient would be, a 10 in that, would guarantee that a casual reader in an enclosed space where jet engines are being tested at 30-second intervals will catch virtually every nuance. Now, Stephen Hawking was actually the target of this article. He scored a 1 in the first category out of 10, and a 3 in the casual reader in enclosed space, which really threw me. I thought a 1 would have been more appropriate there. However, when you multiply them together, you get the idea that out of every 100 people that bought A Brief History of Time, 3 read it. I think that's probably pretty accurate. Now, I hasten to say I read it from cover to cover, but that's not what we want at BERS. We don't want to communicate with an audience of whom only 3 out of 100 are actually going to consume what we're communicating. And I've just made a realization that I have a very important piece of paper in my briefcase outside on the bench, which that would be great. I'm going to have to stretch a little bit now. Fortunately, I'm in television where that's basically all you ever do. So let me say that having said what I've said, that is that I think we want to reach beyond the ready-made audience for math. One of the most important things, and perhaps the most important thing about communicating tough subjects, thank you, like the sciences or math, the problem is that people do not bring any kind of context to it. Now, you and I all know that in our offices, our respective offices, over the next couple of weeks, there'll be Academy Award polls where people will be voting on who's going to win the Oscar for Best Picture, who's going to win the Oscar. This is extremely difficult, what I'm doing, trying to look and talk at the same time. I found it, though. And the same is true in this great country of hockey, and it's true everywhere of politics. People bring a context to the information so that you don't have to start at ground zero. You can start somewhere above that. And it's much easier to communicate when the people that you're communicating with already bring something to the table. Well, my contention is that when it comes to science and math, we're dealing with a pretty small amount of context that people bring to the table. And rather than just assert that, although, having spent nearly 30 years in science communication, I probably am entitled to, I'd like to give you some examples from my favorite scientific paper ever written. It appeared in Nature in 1992. It's called The Growing Inaccessibility of Science, written by Donald Hayes, a sociologist at Cornell, who applied techniques of lexical difficulty to science articles, because his contention was that with time, and he was thinking of from the 40s and 50s on to the present, science journals have become more and more inaccessible, more and more difficult to read, and thereby leaving the general public, that portion of it that used to read them, far behind. So here's what he did. He set at arbitrary 0.0 the average difficulty of an international English language newspaper. Those of us who live in cities that have tabloids know that there's really no such thing as an English language newspaper. But for the sake of argument, let's take that as zero. He then found the most difficult article that he found was an article on the transhydrogenase reaction in Nature. It was rated at 55.5. So there you have a sense, right there. Working downward, an article in Science, 44.8, Cell, 38.0, another Nature article, 31.6, Physics Today, 13.3. I have to apologize in advance. No mathematical journals were included in this analysis because lexical and analysts don't count equations as language. So you need only multiply the difficulty of what I'm saying by the fact that there would be equations in math. So the International English Language Newspaper is zero. Discover, the popular science magazine in the U.S., is minus 4.7. And if you're laughing now, you're going to be in the aisles in a few minutes. Adult Books, fiction, American, minus 19.3. Ranger Rick, that's a natural history magazine for kids, minus 22.6. Comic books, British and American, minus 26.8. Children's books, fiction, British, minus 27.4. Children's books, fiction, American, minus 32.3. And the last three, adult-to-adult conversations, comma, casual, minus 41.1. Mothers talking to their 3.5-year-old children, minus 48.3. And the last one came in at minus 59.1. Farm workers talking to their dairy cows. So I phoned Donald Hayes when I came across this article and I said, what do farm workers say to their dairy cows? I know it's almost late enough in the day to be profane, but I'm sort of planning to have a little bit of profanity later on, so I don't want to overdo it. He basically said, it's get along, you blankety blank blank, and then a few bossies thrown in, and get along, but basically it's a five-word conversation. So, note this, minus 59.1 is farm workers talking to dairy cows. That's really the polar opposite to the Nature article and the transhydrogenase reaction at 55.5. So we have our work cut out for us. I might just add a few notes from the latest survey on scientific literacy that was conducted, Discovery Channel participated in 1995, and just a couple of examples. There's some encouraging news. 95% of the population believes the center of the Earth is hot and also that sunlight can cause skin cancer. They're a little less certain at 78% about the Earth going around the sun or vice versa. And according to that, that would suggest that 22% of the population thinks that radioactive milk can be made safe by boiling it. Around 50%... The Earth does go around the sun, but we're not sure how long. And the really encouraging thing was that from the previous survey, more people realized that humans did not share time on Earth with the dinosaurs. That was up from 47% to 58%. However, we still have 10% of people, as of 1995, who think astrology is, quote-unquote, very scientific. Okay. So that's the general picture. I can summarize, if you ever want a quick quip about scientific literacy, it's roughly this. 5% of the North American population can understand an article in Time magazine about science. That's a pretty stunning figure. And as you'll see when I show you some videotape from our television show, it really puts very tight reins on what one can do as a science communicator. Now, please understand, this is a speech of generalities, and I know that there are exceptions. There are TV series like Cosmos, there are great radio series about science, and so on. But I'm talking about the general run of things, and I frankly don't think that it's getting better. In fact, the International Congress of Science, Television Science Producers in Berlin in the fall, the general consensus was that there's less demand for TV science documentaries now than there was even 2 years ago. Now, what other evidence might I produce to give you an idea of where we have to tread softly when we're considering communicating math to the general public? Can anyone give me some advice on how I can get... There we are. Psychologists, for the last 20 years, have been investigating whether or not human beings have innate numerical abilities. Are we born with some kind of mathematical knowledge? This is an incredibly fascinating field because it's extremely contentious, but it's very interesting as well. So in 1980, for instance, in probably the first experiment that really opened this field up, a psychologist named Prentice Starkey, working with 6-month-old babies, showed, to his satisfaction at least, that they can discriminate the difference between two and 3, or 2 and 1. Now, in case you're not familiar with this kind of experimentation, it's very hard to quiz a 6-month-old child as to what they know about math, but there's a way of doing it. 6 months old and even younger babies and even newborns will pay more attention to something that's novel than they will to something that's already boring them. So, on that and what you do is you have them facing a screen with two images or two different screens. You have an experimenter just watching from the other side who doesn't know what's on the screens watching their eyes. And they will pay attention or shift attention depending on what they're more interested in. So Prentice Starkey showed children slides, two dots, two dots, two dots, until they, quote-unquote, habituate. They're not really paying any attention. Three dots, immediately they pay more attention. Their length of time looking at the screen goes from 1.9 seconds on average to 2.5 seconds. Switch it around, threes, habituate them to three, go back to two. Five and six-month-old children. Now, there were immediate criticisms raised because it's very hard in these experiments to have the number as your only variable. The density of dark on light changes as soon as you add another circle. The total amount of these total surface area that's colored changes as you add a circle. So from that time in 1980 till now, there's been a lot of controversy. I'm going to tilt today toward believing there is some numerical ability, but one could take the other tack, I think. So Prentice Starkey showed that there was at least an apparent ability to discriminate one from two from three. Another set of experiments in the early 80s showed that there may be some abstraction going on here because you can change the modality. You can have children looking at screens with twos and hearing drum beats from a central speaker, and if there's a match, two objects, two drum beats, they're more interested. If there's a mismatch, three objects, two drum beats, or vice versa, they don't appear to be as interested. And then Karen Wynn came out with a fantastic experiment in 1992 in Nature using the same paradigm, not quite the same. Here's what she did. She was interested to know, by the way, having shown that children may have some sense of number, she wanted to know if they could manipulate those numbers. So here's what she did. A little theatrical scene that a baby same age looking at. A hand, I can't do this very easily, but imagine a bare stage. A hand puts a Mickey Mouse doll on and then covers it up with a screen. So it's like that. Another hand brings a second Mickey Mouse doll in, puts it behind the screen. Unbeknownst to the child, one of them is removed. Then the screen comes down. Is the child surprised that two Mickey mice? I got 68 in English, too. The two came in and only one was left. Yes, they are. If it's two, they don't look as long as if it's one. She did the reverse. Put in two, subtract one, apparently subtract one, but in fact, when you drop the screen, there's still two. Children are surprised. Then there have been all kinds of elaborations of these experiments with turntables to see if, because maybe it's the positioning of the objects that the child is paying attention to. And I mean, I appreciate the critics' work in this because it's very important to nail this down as to whether something is numerical or not. I won't go into the... I'll give you one of the mathematical issues here, and that is if you're concerned about total surface area of the numbers of dots that you're displaying, and that maybe these 5 months old are paying attention to that, you've got to be careful not just to normalize the area because the area is pi r squared, as I happen to know, but the circumference of the circles is 2 pi r, you change one, if you equate one, you're rendering the other different, and maybe the children are picking up on that. So what you're seeing here is Karen Wynn's latest attempt to try and really prove that these children are paying attention to number. Now, if I'm... if I can get this rolling, I can do it like that. Here's what they see. I'm only going to show you one. There's several examples. This is basically what the children are looking at, these very young children. What she habituates them to, though, are groups of two. I'm sorry, yeah, groups of two. Let me back up. She habituates them to either two groups or four groups. And in this case, you're looking at twos, but she actually starts with threes. So the children are watching, are they watching two groups of objects? Are they watching four groups? And then she switches it around to something like this. Now here there's four groups, two objects in each group. Children who were habituated to the opposite are now seeing two groups of four objects each. The beauty of this is you've got exactly the same number of objects, exactly the same color, exactly the same amount of visual density, exactly the same area of objects, exactly the same contour, total contour. The question is, if they're used to watching four groups and then they're switched to two, do they pay more attention? Yes, they do. If they're used to watching two groups and then they suddenly see this, four groups, do they pay more attention? Yes, they do. So I'm no psychologist, you know, but I'm very impressed with this information, and I think that this kind of experimentation really does establish that we probably do bring, right out of the womb, some kind of innate sense of numbers. Now, you'll see where I'm getting in a second. How does this apply to adults, and in particular, the kind of adults that we might be trying to communicate with? If we're already born with a sense of number, maybe that would be something you could build on. Well, the news isn't actually all that good. Because it seems that with these children, these 5-month-old children, they're good at 1, 2, and 3, marginally good at seeing the differences between 3 and 4, and beyond that, they can't tell the difference, especially if the numbers are close together. And all of that is still true of adults. You know that if you take any of us, display dots on a screen and have you indicate with a push button 1, 2, or 3, people are very fast with 1, little bit slower with 2, little bit slower with 3, but once it gets to 4 dots, reaction time goes up quite dramatically. We're much slower at knowing what that number is, 4, 5, 6, and on. And the rate of errors goes up rapidly too. There is a kind of disjunct at the number 3 where error rates and reaction times seem to climb. And it seems that no matter how much training adults get, we are hampered by both something called the numerical distance effect and the numerical size effect. It's easier if two numbers, 2 and 9, are flashed on a screen, it's easy to say, and quickly, those are different. But if the numbers are 4 and 5, it takes people many milliseconds longer to discriminate that. The best example I ever heard was a man named Stanislaus Dehaene was working with students at the University of Oregon, and their task was, you're thinking of the number 5, push the left button if the number you see is less than 5, push the right button if the number you see is greater than 5. And the only numbers they saw were 1, 4, 6, and 9. What could be easier? You see 1 or 4, you push the left button. You see 6 or 9, you push the right. After 1,600 trials, the students were still slower when they saw 4 and 6 to indicate whether that was to the left or right of 5 than they were if the number was 1 or 9. That's the numerical distance effect and the numerical size effect. Now, what Dehaene argues is, you know those books I mentioned at the beginning about square root of minus 1 and e and pi and phi? The problem that most people have with numbers like that is that they aren't part of this innate numerical sense that we have. We're not bad at positive integers, but anything more obscure than that, we're just not very good. And he includes 0 in that. There was a very interesting example of something odd with 0 in Karen Wynn's experiments. Remember, she does the Mickey Mouse thing, and she'll do 2 minus 1 is still 2. So she did 1 minus 1 and then had 1 as the answer when you would expect 0. But apparently these babies expected, this isn't a pun, nothing. They were not the least surprised when 1 minus 1 equaled 1. She wondered if that wasn't that, well, she actually said, they have no numerical expectations about an operation that would yield 0. Now, I'm putting this all forward, all of this innate numerical sense, you know, not quite tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I do think it has an impact on what people can take in about mathematics. But it's also interesting research, and I think it's research that mathematicians would find interesting. So that's the first part of my talk. I've just sketched out where I think the audience that we would like to be aiming at is. And the question now is, what can we do about it? How can we approach this audience in a way to make mathematics more accessible? Well, as you might have gathered from Bob Moody's introduction, I've been doing science journalism for a long time in Canada, probably nearly 30 years. And I have gray hair, and you know, I'm in television. So you would think, wouldn't you, that this is the perfect opportunity for me to have a kind of Dan Rather, for American, Lloyd Robertson for Canadians, sort of image, and eminence, grise that would be used to communicate science. And you know, I host a daily one-hour science show. I think, as far as we know, it's still the only one in the world. Discovery Channel in the U.S. is taking 1 hour a week of it. I don't know if that's a comment on the audience or not, but they seem to think the American audience can take an hour a week of a science show, not an hour every night. But anyway, let me give you an example. I've just taken some clips from... do I have to do anything to dump this so we can see the video? Perfect. I just have to point at the screen and ask a question. So I've just chosen, you know, more or less at random, five video clips that take an eminent presenter such as myself, and this is how we use people like me to communicate science. So if you could just roll the videotape, please. It's actually usually a bit better than that.
Two, one.
Yes, that's the bed of nails.
Excellent, Jay. Okay,
lying on a bed of nails. Bed of nails on my chest.
Oh, actually,
concrete block.
I can't believe it.
James Bond.
James Bond.
I seem to end up on my back most of the time. Paintball. Here's my favorite. I don't know if any of you know the famous film of the Sasquatch in Northern California. So we went and rented a $100 gorilla suit and went up in the woods. I've got to tell you about this afterwards. I think this is the last clip. There's a very famous film from 1967 purportedly showing a Bigfoot in Northern California. So we thought we would do our little homage to that film, but make it so obvious that it was fake that everyone would just laugh along with us. So, of course, the result was we got three kinds of response. People really angry at us for claiming that Bigfoot doesn't exist. People really angry at us for claiming that it does. And people wanting to know where we'd shot that video so they could get a look themselves. Well, you know, so, okay, I'm poking maybe a little fun at myself, but there's an important lesson in what I just showed you. And that is that television, I've talked about context before, what television works best with by far are people. And I mean, my case is a little bit different because I'm the host and regular viewers get to know me and so they get a laugh out of me, you know, sliding down a hill on a toboggan. But I'm pretty sure that most of the really compelling science stories that we do in our show are in part so because the person associated with them is also compelling. This can work against you. Some of you might have read the book Fermat's Enigma by Simon Singh. Simon Singh's a, I thought it was a good book. He's a great talker. He came to our studio. I did an interview with him about the book. But, and this is television, that day, or maybe all days, Simon Singh wore his hair straight up off his head to a height of about like that, and then cut off at the top. And the people in my office, who are, you know, pretty savvy TV people, could not take their eyes off his hair. And I was saying, but listen to what he's saying about Fermat. No, they were just, look at that hair. So it's a two-sided, it's a double-sided sword. Appearance, unfortunately, means too much in television. On the other hand, people are extremely important. And while when I went into science media in general, my love of science comes from the depth of the story and the intriguing connections that are made in science, as I'm sure is the case in math, obviously. And yet, frustratingly, quite often you never can quite get to that point because people don't bring enough context to the story. And so you have to sort of take a step back and tell the story, as much of the story as you can, in as compelling a way as you can. And that's why people are so important. Now, I'm not suggesting that television is particularly the best. I suspect it isn't. Medium for communicating mathematics. It does have the visual side, which is extremely important. You know, 50% of our brains are devoted to processing visual information. And I think it would always be worth exploring what television could do for the dissemination of mathematics. But it does have these serious constraints. You know, there's some apocryphal survey that I haven't been able to locate yet that claims that 83% of what people take away from a television program is strictly visual. About 15% is, it's got to be like 78. 15% is the sound, and the last 7 or 8% is the actual content. Now, I need to get back to my PowerPoint, which is going to be a real challenge for me. So, would you? No, nobody's there to help me either. Now, this is going to be even harder than. I'm going to close it up here first. I'm going to do this. I'm going to. Is there an end show there? Bob, thank you. Now I'm going to go back up. Actually, I want to start the show again. Excellent. I did it. That's the highlight of my day so far. Thank you. I planted somebody. I don't know if you're familiar with Edward Tufte and his books. One of them is The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. I love the ideas of these books. Some of them are a bit abstruse for me. They're basically statistical graphics. But here's a perfect example of how I think what one should shoot for, which is visual information that superficially is not particularly information rich, but with a little bit of context is. This is a train schedule. At the top left-hand corner is the Paris station. At the bottom left-hand corner should be Lyon. Lyon. The clock time runs across the top and bottom, and the lines indicate the train routes. So if you want to go, at a glance, if you want to go from Paris to Lyon, you can follow any one of the broken lines. The horizontal breaks indicate how long the layover is at that particular station. The angle tells you how quickly, overall, the trip can be made. The shallower the angle, the longer it takes. And your return trips, of course, if you want to go from Lyon back up here, and you want to leave at this time, well, there's a train that'll take you there. You have to lay over until here. Then you can go back up and so on and go all the way back to Paris. And once you get used to reading this map, this schedule, rather, it is a map, isn't it? It's a map and a schedule in one. It's practically wordless, and yet, at a glance, you could tell how fast and when you could get from any one of the stations on this route to any one of the other stations. There's a second version of this that shows the TGV, the Très Grande Vitesse, the super train, and it cuts a line that's almost vertical, running from there to there, which in one line communicates technological progress. It's quite fascinating. So now I should be able to just click on this. I want to go to there. This is a graphic that Edward Tufte, whose name I mentioned a few minutes ago, claims is the best statistical graphic ever created. He also refers to it as complexity subtly integrated into graphical architecture. It's, as you can see from the title, Napoleon's March to Moscow. Starts on the left. The thickness of the line represents the number of troops. Clearly, as the line thins from across to Moscow and back, the army is depleted. It starts off at 422,000 men in June of 1812. It ends up with 10,000. The bottom line here is temperature and date. As you go across here, of course, time is running across this way. The yellowish, greenish is the march to Moscow. The black is the return. You see some odd lines. Those are troops splitting off to cover the flanks of the army. And so you see a particular one there where it splits off at the top and then comes back down to protect the army on the way back. Here there's a particularly disastrous crossing of a river where the size of the army was virtually reduced by half. Now, I can't even suggest how the idea is implicit in this. If I could go back one, I'll just tell you. I've seen people try to animate this, and it's the most pointless exercise I've ever seen. And in fact, if you go to the web, you can find this, and it's animated so that a chunk of it turns blue, and then another chunk turns. It's stupid. I mean, this map allows you to explore it. You don't need to be dragged into somebody else's idea of how fast you should read it. Now, as I was saying before I interrupted myself, I don't know exactly how this could be applied to the communication of mathematics, but the idea that you, in this case, have something like 6 or 7 variables in one graph, that's a brilliant idea to me. I have a couple... How's my time here? I want to play you a piece from radio, but I'll just do... I'll say a couple of things about print before I get there. Yes. That wasn't my phrase, believe me. There was an article in the Toronto Star recently suggesting that to interest... whoever put my PowerPoint together gave us that little sound. That if we want to interest children in mathematics, I'm not going to ask you to read this at all, but the last... In fact, I'm not even going to let you read it, I guess. Anyway, the idea is that you have to use the vernacular more. I'm of two minds about that. I think that plain, clear communication can work just as well as pretending that, you know, Avril Lavigne loved math before she dropped out of high school. So I remain agnostic about that. Now, okay, this is a bit profane, so anybody who doesn't like the language in this, I apologize in advance, but I'll tell you why I think this is one of the best pieces of science writing I've ever seen. This was written by a disillusioned undergraduate named Lucas Koval, who now has actually made it into graduate studies at the University of Wisconsin. And he wrote this paper, and I'm sure it applies to math. I know it applies to science. Trying to do an experiment. So let me just share with you. If people don't like bad language, I'll sort of read it out. My careful theoretical modeling and painstaking experimentation revealed that my equipment's crap, as are all the available texts on the subject. This whole exercise was a complete waste of my time. I'll just get a couple of the highlights. The upshot is if you heat up a sample of germanium, electrons will jump from a non-conductive energy band to a conductive one. Blah, blah. This relationship between temperature and resistivity can be shown to be exponential in certain temperature regimes by waving your hands and chanting, to first order! I sifted through the box of germanium crystals, chose the one that appeared to be the least cracked. Then I soldered wires onto the crystal spot shown in figure 2B of lab handout 32. Do you have any idea how hard it is to solder wires to germanium? I'll tell you, real goddamn hard. Anyway, there's more to it than that. Let me just see if I can pull up the second page, because the second page is even better. This is the best part. That's bona fide, 100% real data, my friends. I took it myself over the course of 2 weeks, and this was not a leisurely 2 weeks either. I busted my ass day and night in order to provide you with nothing but the best data possible. Now let's look a bit more closely at this data, remembering that it's absolutely first rate. You see the exponential dependence? I sure don't. I see a bunch of crap.
banking on my hopes that whoever grades this will just look at the pictures, I drew an exponential through my noise. I believe the apparent legitimacy is enhanced by the fact that I used a complicated computer program to make the fit. I understand this is the same process by which the top quark was discovered. And that's the end of that. Now, you know, every ex-science student I've shown this to is reacting just as you are. Now, the problem is, it's sort of hard to find a media forum to put things like this. And it exists on the web, but nowhere else, which... Anyway, you know what I think? There's a point here, again, about context and people, and maybe a little bit of a back reference to that newspaper article, that if you can approach people in the vernacular, you can get reactions that might be good ones. And the thing is about this is that it pokes a lot of holes in what science is supposed to be, and in turn, what is often a turnoff about science for people. You know, it's austere and it's complex data. This cuts through all of that. I think it's probably absolutely true, and is entertaining besides. So I'm a big fan of that. Now, I'm just going to finish by playing a little bit of radio with the following introduction. Radio would appear at first glance to be a terrible medium for doing mathematics. You know, numbers don't work well on television, even when you can show them as you say them. Obviously, they'd be much more difficult in radio. What radio is very good at, though, is establishing that personal connection. And again, I hate to be sort of redundant about this, but once you have the context, it can be very, very powerful. So could we turn off Lucas Koval's very funny thing here? And if you could, what I'm going to do, I just want to play about a minute of this audio tape that was recorded about 10 years ago. And I'll just let you listen to the exchange. It's a woman and a man. And then I will get them to stop it, and I'll explain who the people are, and then you can listen again. And you'll see just how amazing the difference can be when you understand the context. Okay, so if we could have the tape, please.
How long have you had trouble remembering things?
That I don't know myself. I can't tell you because I don't remember.
Well, do you think it's days or weeks, months, years?
Well, see, I can't put it exactly on a day, week, or month, or year basis.
But do you think it's been more than a year that you've had this problem?
I think it's about that, about a year or more. Because I believe I had this is just a thought that I'm having myself, that, I possibly have had an operation or something.
Uh-huh. Okay,
tell me about that. And can we stop it there, please? So here's the story. That's a man who's only known by his initials, H.M. He's one of the most famous cases in psychology. 50 years ago this year, he had an operation to resolve severe epileptic seizures that he'd been suffering from. He was 27 years old at the time. The operation was a bilateral temporal lobectomy. They actually removed the entire hippocampus from his brain. The hippocampus, as we now know, is responsible for laying down new memories. So since 1953, he has not created a single new memory about anything. So he is unaware of John F. Kennedy, of anything that's happened since 1953. He still remembers his childhood, although, distressingly, his memories of his childhood in Hartford, Connecticut are slowly fading, supporting the idea that our childhood memories only really are retained because we continually refurbish them by retelling them. The woman who's interviewing him on our behalf is Suzanne Corkin. She's a neuropsychologist at MIT. She's been working with him since the late 50s. So this is a conversation with a man who has no idea, who knows that he has a memory deficit, interestingly, because if I introduce you to him and then you leave the room and you come back a minute later or 2 minutes later, he doesn't remember ever having met you. If you tell him that his favorite aunt has died, she died in 1958, he's overcome with remorse, but then 5 minutes later, he doesn't remember. So let's hear a little bit more of this, and I think knowing with that background,
you'll just see how powerful I at least think this interview is. Okay.
I remember if I don't remember just where it was done in.
Do you remember your doctor's name?
No, I don't.
But he knows something went wrong in the operation.
Does the name Dr. Scoville sound familiar?
Yes, that does.
Tell me about Dr. Scoville.
Well, he did some traveling around. He did medical research on people.
Was
all kinds of people in Europe too, and the royalty.
That's right.
And out in the movie stars too.
Did you ever meet him?
Yes, I think I did.
Do you know where you met him?
I think I met him in his office.
And where was that?
Well, I think of Hartford right away.
Uh-huh. Where in Hartford?
Well, to tell you the truth, I can't tell you the address number or anything. But I know it was down the main part of Hartford, but it was off the main section.
Was it at a hospital?
No. The first time I met him was in his office.
Mm-hmm.
Before I went to a hospital. And there, what he learned about me helped others too, and I'm glad about that.
Right. What do you do to try to remember?
Well, that I don't know, because I don't remember what I tried.
Is it harder for you to remember things than it is for other people to remember things?
Yes, I think it is. But, and funny thing, I go with crossword puzzles now
mm-hmm.
a lot more than I used to.
Really? Why is that?
Because then maybe I remember words. And sometimes I don't have to look them up. I remember them.
You are terrific at remembering words.
And, well, I know I started doing the crossword puzzles in books. I know I got several books here, and I belong to that club too.
Tell me about the club.
Well, they send me, get me to join it, and it's the. Well, this is the crossword club in Old Saybrook.
Okay, that's good. There's a point in this interview when he says, "You know, I wanted to be a doctor myself. But I wear glasses, and I was afraid that in the middle of an operation, that my glasses might fall off and I might make the wrong cut." And then about 2 minutes later, in the same interview, he says, "You know, I wanted to be a doctor, but I wear glasses, and I was afraid that blood would spurt up onto my glasses and I might make the wrong cut." It's pretty eerie to listen to this man whose life was ruined by a surgeon whom he still greatly respects, although Scova's long since dead, and that somehow in that mind, which I think it would be impossible for any of us to imagine what's in there, that he, you know, that there's something about doctors and incorrect cuts and what he wanted to do with his life. I'd love to meet that man. He's getting pretty old, though. And he's never been on... They won't put him on television because to protect his privacy. So, anyway, I think it's a perfect example of when you know what you're thinking about and what you're talking about, even something like radio, even mere words, can be very moving. So just to sum up quickly, I think that the fact that Burrs wants to communicate what's going to go on here in the next few years is a tremendous goal. It's a laudable goal. I'd love to... take some small part of it on myself if I could. And I think that the things like context, the challenge, well, let me say, the parts of mathematics that perhaps don't get communicated well, the challenge, personal quest, the excitement, the controversy, the struggle, all of those very personal things, I think, should be part of that communication. And exactly how we'll do it, I don't know. But I think with great mathematicians and creative writing workshops and hardworking people, it should be a success. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. This is I added another dimension to our afternoon's proceedings, and one perhaps which we haven't talked about before, and I think which is well known internationally as an artistic community, has wonderful programs in music, sound, programs in visual arts, ceramics. All sorts of wonderful artists are here all the time. It's a tremendously stimulating environment already. So we're moving into this environment, and we would like to interact with it. And so one of the big challenges facing us, and one of the perhaps most interesting ones, is how to reach this broader public and to do it in a meaningful way within the context of the Banff Center here. So we indeed do have a creative writing workshop that Jay was alluding to. It's coming up in September of this year, and in fact there will be another creative writing workshop, a continuation of it, in 2004. But we will be looking for ways in which to expand our program into things which are not directly the things we normally associate with mathematics workshops. So that's a challenge. That's one of the things that makes being here very exciting for us. And I'm very glad that we had today these three speakers, who really gave us quite a broad perspective of the type of activities that occupy people's minds who are going to be here, and the kind of things we can expect from BERS in the future. So thank you all for being here, and we'll continue with our celebrations. We have a reception coming up pretty soon in the dining room, in the mezzanine at the dining room, and then we'll have a banquet later on. So thanks very much for being here this afternoon, and we'll see you later.